All right, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the third first round session of the 2011 Student Speaker Challenge. I'm just first going to request that everyone please turn off their cell phones so there's no disruptions. Thanks. The 2011 Student Speaker Challenge is presented in partnership by the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, the Lethbridge Public Interest Research Group, the University of Lethbridge, and the University of Lethbridge Students Union. My name is Vanessa Lodemeyer, and I'm a fifth-year student here at the U of L, majoring in anthropology, sociology, and political science. And I will be your moderator for today's session. Our presenters today will address the question, what is global justice and how can it be achieved? Both presenters will have 15 minutes to present their respective responses to the question, and an additional 15 minutes will be allotted to each presenter following their presentation to answer questions from our panel of judges as well as from the audience. Following the conclusion of both presentations and question periods, our judges will hand in their scorecards, at which point the winner of today's session will be announced. The winner will receive $100 courtesy of SACPA and move on to the semi-final round of the 2011 Student Speaker Challenge, which will begin after reading week. At every Student Speaker Challenge session, the panel of judges consists of one student, one faculty member, and one community member. Our student judge for today's matchup is Jillian Ayres. She is a graduate student in the Sociology Department and a member of the LPERT Board. The faculty judge is Dr. Cheryl Leheden, a professor in the Faculty of Management, specializing in Human Resources and Organizational Studies. The community judge is Corinne Jerky. She is a member of Kairos, which is an ecumenical group here in Lethbridge, and she's worked with them for around 18 years on social justice issues, locally as well as internationally. We are expecting a very interesting contest today between Channing Stenhouse and Sarah Ortiz Espina. Channing Stenhouse is a socially conscientious fifth-year music major who intends on pursuing graduate studies. Sarah Ortiz Espina, originally from Colombia, grew up in Montreal. She is a 20-year-old anthropology major who has been active in Canada World Youth, an organization that saw her volunteering in Quebec and in Mali. It is time to begin. By virtue of a coin toss, it has been decided that Sarah will speak first. Please welcome Sarah.
Good afternoon, everyone. So before I start, everyone can hear me? Yeah. If my accent gets too thick, because I'm really nervous, just let me know. Okay. So what is global justice and how can it be achieved? A year ago, I thought I knew what global justice was. I was sure of my ideals. I was sure of my values. Then I got accepted to go to an intercultural exchange to Mali in Africa and then in Quebec. So I stayed 3 months in Karajé, that's the town where I stayed, and I lived with a family, I worked with them, I did everything with them, they became my family. I went because I wanted to contribute to do something for the world, because we see everywhere that the world is unjust, so I went there with the idea that I wanted to help. Before I left Lethbridge, I received a donation. Maybe a month later, when I was in Karajé, I went to the school and I saw that the benches were really old. So I decided I wanted to buy benches. I went, bought the benches. I was really excited I was going to contribute to this global justice. Then a dispute erupted in the village. I could feel the tension. I couldn't understand why. My African dad came and asked to me, are you my daughter? Of course, I felt I was part of the family. So I said yes. He then asked me why I didn't tell him about my project. So I didn't know what to answer because I thought I was doing something good for the community. After maybe 2 weeks, I realized what I have done. I have disrespected the culture, the way they do things. By imposing them what I thought it was a necessity, because I had benches when I went to school, so I thought it was going to be just for them to have benches. I could not believe I had created such a chaos just trying to achieve this global justice. This experience came up in my mind when I was trying to answer the question, how can global justice be achieved? Sometimes we believe something is good, but for people it's not, and we just create a worse situation than before. So I believe a good start, if we want to achieve global justice, is to create a development aid that is out of any economical and political agendas and really make it based on their diversity and to give the power to the locals, who can then choose their aid. We've done a lot of great achievements, and I'm not saying we've not been improving, but I think we still can improve a lot. So I think if we are able to respect diversity, respect each perspective and each culture, it's going to improve the situation of our world. I'm going to focus largely on NGOs because I had direct experience with them, but also because there's a lot of NGOs. Just in the UN, there's 3,400 NGOs registered. And are these all... I just keep asking to myself, are these NGOs actually being beneficial to the people? And who are they accountable to? To the people or to the people who are actually giving the money? But before, I want to expand on the problems that the development discord can cause on a community. Escobar, a Colombian anthropologist, has studied extensively the problems of the development discourse that he says is always based on comparing the third world to what it lacks to the developed world, which as a consequence assumes that the only way a culture can progress and modernize is if they become like us in our economic and social cultural values. To be developed, you need to have the specific characteristic chosen by the developed world. This form of discourse does not take into account the history and the priorities of different cultures. Development then creates a reality for the people who then start believing that they actually need help, because according to us, they need help. This is a quote from his book, Encountering Development. So many in the third world began to think of themselves as inferior, underdeveloped, and ignorant, and to doubt the value of their own culture. They started instead to pledge allegiance to the banners of reason and progress. When I was in Karaje, there was a lot of people who told me, I really need help, you can help me. And me, as an 18-year-old, how did they start believing that I could help them? It really came up in my mind, like, why would they think they need help? Then I looked around, and there were so many NGOs for everything, health, education, everything. But what really amazed me the most was that there were two schools abandoned in the village. And they told us that an NGO 20 years ago came and told them that they needed a school. And I'm sure this NGO had really great intentions, but they did not consider that they already had an education system. So by building this school, they wanted to make the life of the people better. But according to whom were they going to make the life of the people there better? Surprisingly, when I was leaving Karaje, another school was going to be built by UNICEF. So this example really reflects that, first, we don't learn from our mistakes. And second, we really don't take into account the priorities of each community. Another example of an NGO which also imposed their ideas on community is given by Patrick Wilson, an anthropology professor at the University of Lethbridge, in a critical reflection on tourist-oriented craft production in the Amazonian Ecuador. So an NGO called Finchi Sacha went to Santa Rita, which is in Ecuador, and they wanted to start a production of traditional ceramic. They wanted to alleviate poverty and to create gender equality because it was just going to be the women who were going to be able to work in this craft, in this industry. So the women were going to have money and then were going to have more power in their household. As I said, women were allowed to work there. The NGO really had good intentions, but they did not consider some realities of the community. First, the reality of the gender positions in Santa Rita were different. Women would stay at home, take care of the children, and prepare the meals. So this already creates a lot of tension in the community. Second, the NGO imposed an identity to the woman, because the woman did not do the, for 40 years, they did not work with ceramic. And because this NGO had power, in a sense, they said, this is important for you, you need to regain your lost culture. But it did not come from the woman who wanted to regain their culture. Also, they did not see the economic reality of Santa Rita, because the women were self-sustainable. They would just work in the gardens, but now they actually were dependent on the money to go buy food in the market. So at the end, this NGO created a worse situation than before. Women got beaten worse than before, because this created actually a lot of problems in the community, because the NGO did not work, did not make money, so the women would become, would go back home, spend it all day, and then they would have troubles with their husbands. And at the end, they actually had a lot of problems because they did not work in the garden, did not have money, so they actually had a lot of problems with the food. Again, this is an example of another NGO who went to a community with its own agenda, who did not discuss with the community before implementing their ideals. I might look really pessimistic telling you all about this, but if I believe development aid can actually improve the situation of our world, it's because some NGOs have done great jobs with health issues, with water issues. An example is when I went to Guatemala this summer. I went to visit Roots and Wings, with part of Rowanak, anyway, and it was an NGO that was started by Cristobal. He was from there, and an American who went there and lived there for 2 years. So they decided to start this NGO because a lot of students could not continue post-secondary education because their economic realities were really different, so they did not have money to go to university. And a lot of students applied because they weren't loans, and then now they have 25 students who can actually go to university. And this is really important to see that, because that person, Cristobal, was given the power. I think that's one of the reasons why it is successful now. So, after these examples, I tried to answer the question, what is global justice? So, when I first look at the world, I look global, okay, and then justice. What is justice? Is it distributive? Is it criminal? Is it distributive? What is it supposed to be equally distributive? Power? Wealth? Opportunity? Just the idea of justice, when I was in the village of in Guatemala, there were no police, right? So I asked them how their justice system worked, because I was really amazed. It was really quiet, really safe. And they gave me an example of someone who steals a banana. So that person steals a banana, and then the people take him, put 10 times the weight of the banana on his back, make him kneel on rocks in front of all the village. And then for women, they would cut their hair. Is this justice? So I believe our idea on global justice is a byproduct of our experience, our vision of humans, our culture, our economic position, and our education. How can we choose what definition is better than another? Already, if we decide to ignore a person's idea of global justice, it's already not just. For instance, I was born in Colombia. I arrived in Montreal when I was 7 years old. So for me, immigrant issues are really important. If I had to give a definition of global justice, I would certainly include these issues. But not everyone would. And how can I convince someone that helping immigrants is actually going to improve global justice? This said, even if I don't believe a consensus on global justice is possible, I still think we can and should improve the situation of our world. If we want to improve the global situation of our world, I think we need to consider local justice rather than a global justice. NGOs have helped to create an international solidarity, which I think is really important. And you have helped resistance movements such as the Ogoni movement from Nigeria and the Chipko movement from India that was started there, and the international civil society helped them to achieve what they consider was just. In other words, I think to achieve global justice, we need to start to review our development aid. We need to prevent situations like in Mali and respect the education systems. Let's avoid situations like in Santa Rita, where we made the situation for several women unbearable, and create more NGOs, like Roots and Wings, where young people have the opportunity to start an NGO and to work towards their dreams. International aid is not going to be perfect, but we need to find ways to prevent these types of situations. We have, as I said before, we have improved a lot, but I think I still think we have a lot of work to do. It's just, I chose international aid because it actually affects real people. It shouldn't be possible for us, because we have more power, to actually play with their lives. So I think we need to respect the community, give them power to work on their priorities, rather than us going with the power to decide their needs, which then create more needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, but you weren't really going to sit down yet, because we now are going to have 15 minutes for questions. I'll just ask everyone, please, if you can let the judges have the opportunity to ask their questions first to ensure that they have time to do so, and then after they've asked their questions, we can entertain more questions from the audience. Okay, thanks.
I'm sure there is some negative problems. If I can think of some. No, I can think of some. I'm too nervous. But I think there's always going to be problems in the local. But I think it's not for us to decide, because it actually affects their life, right? Like here, maybe in Lethbridge, we have done decisions that can affect badly in a negative way people, but it's not the outsider who gets to choose, right? It's actually us. So I think, as I said, I think it's a good start. I don't know if it's going to attain global just as betterment of the situation of our world, but I think it's better if they learn from our mistakes rather than us going and not really learning from our mistakes. Thank you.
I have a question about, I like the idea about power to the local, but I'm thinking about the diversity clashes within those groups. Because you're letting them decide on the NGO services or opportunities that they need, which is good. But a lot of the resources for that would come from an external source, I would imagine. And so how do you balance?
Okay, that's a good question. I think it would be really hard to balance it. But I think if we start giving them, let's say, I don't know, I have more experience in small communities. I know it's going to be really hard on larger communities. But I think if we give them the power to choose what they want to do, after the people within their own communities are going to have the, they're going to say something if they're not happy with it. And sometimes you might say, yeah, but in some cultures, you know, the authority needs to be respected. But I'm sure if they really see the inequality, like, I can't talk for each community. It depends how they react. Maybe in some communities they're going to think that's the way to do, and it's going to seem unjust for us, but not for them. So, sorry.
I'm pretty excited, Sarah. I'm pretty excited about
Oh yeah, I struggled a lot when I was there. I was just thinking about all this, because I went with my idea of global justice, and then I was there and it was so different from what we think it is. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we can now open up to questions on the floor. Please.
At one time, global justice was probably better achieved by not interfering with people, but do you think we're beyond that now, where people in that part of the world, they know how we live, and they don't feel happy with their own lifestyle anymore?
Yeah, maybe they... Yeah, it's hard to see because also when I was in Karaje, like my sister, she was telling me how she would love to come here and live here. And it was really hard to tell her that it's not as perfect as we portrayed it. We still have problems here. So it's really hard to tell them, like, no, stop dreaming to come, like, to come to Canada. It's really hard because they really think it's like a better life. So maybe we should start also to showing the bad side because, like, yeah, we have problems, and usually in the international community, we don't hear about those problems. So.
It's like when you're there, there's all kinds of smiles, and when the culture shock is coming back, and seeing those smiles.
Sorry, can I repeat that?
The culture shock, when you go to that part of the world, is not going there, but coming back.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's for sure. When I came back, I had a worse cultural shock than actually being there. It was for 3 months. That's my mom. I didn't want to do anything. So, yeah. Thank you.
And it's never going to be a perfect dialogue or like complete understanding, but it's just such a great platform, right, to begin some kind of understanding of diversity and what's it meant to be a immigrant, say, people from here to the other side or from the other side to here, right?
Yeah.
And it's this kind of interaction, kind of ideas and mindset that I think creates very real possibilities that perhaps one day we are better able to formulate. There are questions about how to go about it.
Yeah, how to actually achieve global justice. Yeah. That's true. Thank you. Really? Well, as I said, I think international solidarity is really important. So, in the case of Coca-Cola, it's really hard they don't really need our help to go and, you know, really change their situation. They just want to be heard. They just want you to know what's going on actually in Colombia and Guatemala, for instance. Like, they are actually willing to share it with us. And I think that's really a good example that I think we need to work together with this international solidarity, but really keeping in mind that we need to respect their ideas of justice. Oh, come on, I'm prepared for this. Well, I went to the school, like, maybe for 2 days, because I just wanted to see how it worked. And first, they have a lot of problems because they speak Bambara, which is the local language, but the system of education is still, France has still a lot to do with the system, so it's in French. So first, kids don't understand what they're learning. Like, I had my brother who would come and ask me what to do because it was all in French. And it's really hard to learn a language, as you all might know, if you're not really immersed in it. So there's still a lot of problems with education. And they told me that before it was more, well, the kids would stay with the grandmothers and learn, which I think is really valuable. And they didn't tell me, like, oh, we don't like schools, but just the school's abandoned, say, a lot. And they have one professor, one teacher. And I think if education is important for us, but if they have other ways of educating, I think we need to respect that. Because if with the grandmother, what are they going to learn? They're going to learn to cultivate, they're going to learn, I don't know what they're going to learn. But how can I see that the knowledge that they're going to learn in school is better than the knowledge that they're going to learn with their grandmother? I heard about my clones. I don't know enough about it. I think it's really an interesting idea. I don't know how. I wouldn't know what to say about that. It depends on how people actually see it, because you can say it's an empowerment because you give them the resources to start. But an example, I don't know if you've seen it, is a movie called documentary called what is it called? It's by Big Moonies, who goes to the landfills and he helps a woman to start like her own restaurant. But then she started her own restaurant, but then she quit and went back to the landfill because she said she felt happier there and she wanted to help other people. So even there, if you gave them the opportunity, if it's not forced, if it's not that you need to have microloans to actually be happy, I think it's a great way. But I don't know.
One part, you may have covered it, but I'm going to the Canadian Charter of the Rights and Freedoms that they have. It's all written down. But it seems to be...
Is it with the UN, too? Or is it just... Okay.
The Canadian Charter of the Rights and Freedoms, which can also racial issues and gender issues and so on are not issues. It seems to me that if we don't identify the fact that these are not actually what do I know, Canada? Canada doesn't do this. Mm-hmm. Aboriginal people do. How are they treated? Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that before we go in NGOs going abroad and so on, why don't we...
No, I completely agree.
And perhaps starting with those matters. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that without that, all the rest is really...
And it's really interesting that you find that, because in Colombia and in other countries, like, the problems that Canada has with Aboriginal people, it's never known. Like, it's really interesting that, as we were saying, like, it's always the good image of the first world. But, yeah, we don't talk about those problems. And a lot of people from other countries have said, like, well, you have problems. Like, do it before, like... do your own things before and then come and say you're helping us. So it's really hard too, because there's some extreme situations of how to say no when, I don't know, it's hard to, like, and, yeah, there's a lot of ideas that I have now in mind.
First of all, I'd like to agree with both of you guys. It's, you want to start local before you can actually take a global justice. It's kind of the best part of some issues. What I was curious about is on the idea of education again is how would you say that it would be beneficial to give children and adults in other countries the opportunity to experience Canada and developed countries for themselves? Would it be good to teach them about what it's like over here truthfully?
Yeah, that's a great question. The problem with that is that when people come, like Canada World Youth, I had a really nice experience, but when I was doing this paper, it really made me think that, well, someone helped me to think about this, but when people come from other countries here, like when we were nine people from Canada and nine people from Mali, they came here to learn, right? Learn how we live. And if we're able to show them the problems that we have, that's great. But it's always the idea that they come to learn, and then we went there to teach them. Again, of the idea that the first world always teaches to the third world. So I think it would be a really nice opportunity, but trying to keep in mind that we're not teaching them. They're going to learn anyways, but not with the idea that they're going to come and learn, because we have better infrastructures, but learn about our problems. I think that would be a really good point. Thank you.
We have time for about one or two more questions.
I was just wondering, I think a life question before the thesis. If I had a great idea for an NGO, or thought I had a great idea, like a Canadian idea, and I go in and I go to Africa and try to do something, and it totally is culturally wrong, but then I see that it's wrong, and then I think, okay, maybe it does the culture a bit more, and I can find a way to work. Would you recommend doing that, or would you recommend just staying in Lethbridge and
there's problems in Lethbridge if you have some problems.
It's not like, being born in Lethbridge, it's not even possible to solve. Where do you start developing it? I have no idea.
Talk to them, ask them.
I've grown up here, but I just can't, I think I can, with a new perspective and a new culture, I feel like I can help more.
Well, I understand because, I understand our need to go and help because, the image that we have of the world is really, they're living really in poverty and I think your idea is nice, but I think before you go with your agenda of what you think is the solution, you need to talk to the people. Instead of going and implementing your idea already, you need to go there and talk to them, and after reflecting, and sometimes maybe you won't like their way of seeing justice. So are you going to think your way of seeing justice is better than theirs? It's really hard to actually,
I'm ready for change.
You're ready for change? Oh, if you want to try. No, that's good. Thank you.
I think that's all for questions, so let's take a break here.
So now, if we do have time, we'll be doing a 5-minute break. Is this right? It will be a very short, exactly 5-minute break. So you can just get some more refreshments, if you please.
Good job.
Okay, hi everyone. I think we'll all get seated again and we can get started. Just give you a few minutes. So now we will have Channing, and she will have 15 minutes to present her thesis, and we'll do the same question period as well. So please welcome Channing.
Can everybody hear me okay? Great. This is a stapler, if anybody's wondering, so I'm not doing anything suspicious. I'm just nervous and I need to click. All right, so what is global justice and how can it be achieved? It's perhaps the most daunting question I have ever approached. So I think we should start with, what is global justice? Is it a universal right to education, as many people would argue? Is it a universal right to equality? Is it dealt by a judicial court based on legal criteria? Is it our current system? Does justice even have to be fair? What is global justice? I can't tell you what global justice is. I can't tell you what global justice is because I have no idea what global justice is. What I do know is that life is not fair. All men and women are not created equal. We're not created equal in that we are not the same. We live in different places, are raised with different beliefs. We have different aspirations and abilities. We will never be the same. I know that some will always be smarter than others. Some will be better looking than others. Our Canadian injustice. Some will always be warmer than others. Some will have more, and some will have less. And some will need more, and some will need less. I know that these differences are bound to lead to a multiplicity of life's realities. Inequality will always exist between people. So what I know is that life is not fair, but things can be better. In the developed Western world, we tend to share a common belief that a functional democracy brings about the greatest good for the greatest number. Our own Canadian political system, although it's not perfect, is that of a democracy. All Canadians have a right to vote, and all votes are counted equal. By participating in this process, Canadians can vote for what they believe will bring about the greatest good. You can vote either what will bring about the greatest good for yourself, or you can vote for what you believe will bring about the greatest good for all. But the underlying principle is that at the end of the day, when the votes are tallied, the greatest good will come about for the greatest number of people, the greatest number of Canadians. But it stops there. It is our representatives' duty to act in our best interest, the best interests of Canadians. But we are not an island. We Canadians number almost 34 million. But there exists roughly 6,800,000,000 other people on Earth. This last part is the key, on Earth. Now, it's not revolutionary to think of the planet as a whole. In 1945, 51 nations formed the United Nations. The United Nations acts today as an international forum, mediating disputes, promoting peace and democracy, supplying aid to countries in need, and in some cases, even eradicating disease. What we need perhaps, though, more than an institute of international mediation is global governance. No more can we act as though the problems affecting people across the ocean are not our own. We often hear talks of the effects of globalization. Globalization is described as the process through which regions become more interdependent. The mainstream media lends a lot of time to the economic discussion of globalization. Crop failure in A increases food prices in B, which threatens C's security and makes D's currency plummet. With trade relations being perhaps the hottest topic on the agenda of almost all nations' leaders, globalization is increasingly important. But who is it that reaps the benefit of this globalization? Does the wealth of a nation increase drastically from economic specialization in trade? Does GDP go up? Does social well-being increase? Those making the most gains in the current system of globalization are corporations. It is the corporations who make money off the backs of nations, and nations are almost powerless in their struggle against these multinationals. Taxes could be collected in order to share the wealth among the people, but when the taxes are imposed, the corporation pulls its business and relocates to an area with cheaper labor and supplies, rendering the First Nation jobless and destroying national economies, destroying people's lives. It is with this attitude that we see a constant changing of the corporate map. No longer are our shoes made in Mexico or our light bulbs manufactured in the USA. Instead, the labor has relocated to a sweatshop in Taiwan. Nations do not benefit from this system. The people do not benefit from this system. What we need to do to rein in this corporate free-for-all is to stop corporations from being able to simply relocate their problems. This must be done by allowing a global governing body to act on behalf of all citizens, citizens of the world. As a global governing body would be able to say no to relocation. A global governing body would be able to say yes to labor unions. A global governing body could put an end to the seemingly insatiable thirst of corporations and at long last, impose a system of tax collection that would be beneficial for the people. A global governing body at this point would have many obstacles to overcome. Our current world order is largely dependent on nation states. A nation state is a sovereign entity and would probably oppose adhering to a global government. Many others, if we look to the model provided us by the UN, would worry about the lack of the trickle-down effect. Nations' leaders are not all democratically elected, and therefore the people are not always represented. What I propose to fix this, unless in confrontation with sovereign nations, is a global democracy in which every nation must hold a free election, not to elect their national leaders, I'm not calling for the absolution of national borders, but to elect their global representative on this new layer of government. Imagine this to be much like the local system of local, provincial, and federal government that we have here in place in Canada. Each level of government has a different set of responsibilities and capabilities. Each level has a separate set of elections where the people of a particular constituency each have the right to vote. Each level of government works together to provide the greatest good for Canadians. What I propose is that we use our current system of nation states to create a larger, separate body that can help create the most good for the largest number of people. Rather than having a nation's representative be appointed by the leader of that country, who may have come to power by peaceful or other means, each representative would be elected by the people. This does not force regime changes on any nation, but instead ensures that the people are truly being represented, at least at some level, and aids in the assurance of the trickle-down effect. This representative could then work with the national or regional governments to help properly allocate resources supplied by a global government, and a people's representation is guaranteed. Well, we need a tax base, basically, is the next thing. So according to the New York Times this past year, American businesses earned profits at an annual rate of $1.65 trillion. This is profit. Now, I understand that in order to maintain development and growth, that companies must earn a profit so that they may reinvest and keep our economies alive. But at this point, rather than reinvesting profits, many companies are holding on to their cash while continually giving large bonuses to elite members of the corporations. Millions of workers have lost jobs because companies have cut production in an attempt to deal with a global decline in demand. Meanwhile, there has been a decline in global demand because workers are being laid off and wages remain stagnant. Some workers have been asked not only to work longer hours, but also to accept less pay for the hours worked. With employment scarce and corporations willing to relocate for resources, the laborer is forced to accept or starve. This outrageous economic model, whereby human efforts sell for pennies, can be stopped if we unite in a global effort. A global government could be given the ability to enforce labor laws, environmental policies, and help establish more of a purchase power parity, but in the sense that a person's labor would be equal to that, the labor of somebody else across the world. A global government could impose a flat tax rate on corporations that would not infringe upon a nation's ability to attract business, as it would be static everywhere. This new source of revenue could eradicate disease, fund education, eliminate hunger, and even help to create jobs. Things can be better as a whole. We need to start looking at the planet not as a collage of nations, but as a single canvas painting of one people. We have one people, one planet. We only get one shot. So what do we do? While my words now will sound more like the echo of a crowd somewhere in Tunisia or Egypt, we must take action. We, especially here in Canada, with all our freedom and opportunity, must elect leaders who represent our needs rather than cater to the business elite. Corporate tax exemptions must stop. We must not stand for the disembowelment of our labor unions. We need government creation or UN reform, however you'd like to put it, but we need to continue our consideration beyond our borders. It's time for change. It's time for a government of the people, for the people. It is time for justice to take on meaning beyond that of international economic business. It is a time for global governance. I'd like to conclude with a call to action. Now, these words, bear with me, will sound like I'm kind of coming from the left field. But I'd like to address you, the academic community, about an issue I feel is impeding our ability to inspire change. I often hear many of my colleagues complain that we Westerners are apathetic. I do not believe that the people are of an apathetic nature. The people here in Canada and North America don't not care. They don't know. And they don't know because we don't take the time or make the effort to properly tell them. It is our responsibility as academics to inform the people so that they may make informed decisions for their betterment. But so often, when we do make an attempt, we use unnecessary jargon. We're kind of dry. There's an extreme disconnect between academia and the public. They don't trust us because we don't take the time to explain ourselves in layman's words. We don't take the time to reach out. The people are capable of understanding. It is we who don't speak the vernacular. My call then to you is to speak to the people, make your voices heard, and share the knowledge that we've gained here. You're the experts. We've all shown persistence in our studies. Now let's show that same persistence in our lives. Make your voices heard, speak eloquently and with passion, and let none who will listen evade you. Help make the change that we need, inspire that change, and be that change. Thank you.
Thank you, Channing. All right, now we'll do the same format with 15 minutes of questions, again, starting with the judges to make sure they get time to air their questions, and then moving on to the whole audience. Thanks.
Thanks, Jenny. That was excellent as well. Very good. I was quite interested in your position on democracy. I think that you have some excellent points there. And I'm wondering about the structure of democracy in our country, or in North America in particular, and voter apathy. So if we're going to discuss about a great structure, then really is it serving the greatest good? Or is it serving the people that can mobilize themselves in a special interest who can then vote and change the political landscape?
Okay, so on the issue of voter apathy, I completely agree with you. It is a huge concern in not just this country, but in many countries. And that's actually where I think my last little call to action comes from. I think that the people, it's not that they're apathetic. It's not that the people don't care. Many people are disillusioned with our government. They don't think that their vote can make change. And even if they do, sometimes they believe they're not 100% familiar with the issues. And I think that as an academic community, as you know, these people, everybody here has drive, has passion for something, that it's our job to make sure that these people aren't apathetic, in that if we tell them what's going on and what sort of, we explain properly exactly how they can get together and make this change, they won't be apathetic. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Wondering if you think that this democratic framework could be implemented in every culture. So, what you think would lead to law and justice if each country would have the same democratic frame? Do you think that's doable in every culture?
Okay, well, I think that right now, like I said, there would be a lot of issues if we were to go and try and implement a global government, especially one that questioned the sovereignty of a nation. And I really don't think that we should question the sovereignty of a nation in many respects. People cling to, I'm excited to be a Canadian. I enjoy my heritage, and I don't think that I should say that, as a Canadian, that my beliefs as a democratic culture should be imposed on somebody else. But the thing is, I guess, is that if the people of a different country believe something else, and they take a vote on it, their results will show their beliefs. And in that sense, their representative then could act on the behalf of their very different beliefs from my belief system here. So I do think that it could work. I also think that this system of a global governing body would have to work alongside, more as a parallel governing body, alongside and aiding nations, rather than contesting their power and trying to implement things over top of national priorities. Yes.
Okay, so let's go to the Herald and Egypt. And here we have a classic example of the huge difficulty that we have in making these changes, where the United States elite, the Canadian elite, are promoting the Egyptian elite. I don't know if you agree.
Oh, yes, of course, of course.
So I guess my question for you is, okay, so how do we deal with that? When we have this, you know, and they're quite open with it, that we would rather have this, you know, good elite group running things than hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who are out there, you know, trying to do that. I think while we've got those issues, and it's pretty difficult to look at the notion of a, you know, worlds, you know, sort of thing. You know, in fact, we already have the United Nations. The United Nations is nothing.
Okay, so if I can kind of get your question here, I think that the United Nations is, first of all, it's an international governing body. It looks at people as though they're different depending on which nation they come from. And what I'm proposing would be more of a global body that wouldn't look at a person in Egypt and call them an Egyptian, that would just think of them as a citizen in and of that governing body. At the same time, I would ask you, why is the focus in our media the issues going on in Egypt? And while I thoroughly agree that our dictators, but that's just personal opinion, that our politicians are pushing for a dictator, I think that if we looked at our national issues, our regional issues, that we would find that we wouldn't need so much to be paying attention to what's going on in Egypt and Tunisia. And that if we were properly call to action, you know, covering our issues, we perhaps wouldn't have these politicians in place who are pushing for people holding on to a dictatorship, a dictatorial regime. I think that if we were properly educated on our issues and how we could affect them, we might have some different people in power even here at home. Does that answer your question?
I'd like to say a little bit more about how we educate the voters. Like, don't have to go to Egypt, but we just say to Canada, there's all sorts of issues we could solve at home that we would have people who are more enlightened and less dictatorial at the top. We have the states that the president gave a wonderful State of the Union address. Real true, I think, are complex because the large corporate entities that control the Senate and the Congress really got to their elected representatives. They don't know how to get to their elected representatives. Happy to lose their body. They sure as hell know how to use their richness, their wealth, to get to majority in one or other of the houses and stifle the good ideas that were out of Obamacare via healthcare, for instance. So how do you, given the reality in Canada States, which is a lot closer to home than Egypt, how do we educate the voters to be more informed, and therefore they would care and be less apathetic?
Okay. I think that, well, first of all, in Canada, we kind of have this issue whereby we think that Canadian politics, much like some of our words and our works, are dry. We think that they're boring. And I think that if we actually start to uncover the issues, we can look, even in going into the education system and just revamping the education system, making sure that the experts are the people in charge of what gets taught and how things get taught. Also, we also seem to have somewhat of an idea, at least I'm familiar with this with my family and such, that education, once you're kind of done school, you're just done learning and you don't really have to pay attention anymore because you know what it is that you know and you're just going to go on with your life. I think that if we speak eloquently and with passion, that and in the vernacular language, that if people just hear this, they'll be like, wait, that's going on around here, and start actually paying attention. If we look at what's going on in, I check my Facebook all the time, and we look at what's going on in Egypt and how everybody's claiming that this is the Facebook revolution. We have those social media tools here. We just need to use them better. Does that answer your question? Okay. Let me know if this answers your question. North American democracy, I don't think, is 100% functional, and I'm sure that many, many people here would agree. But it's a start. And as I said, life's not fair, but we can make it better. And I think that it's that system of betterment that we need to work towards. And the concept of how corporations play into that, I mean, I personally would preach Marx to you, but I don't think that that's it 100%. I don't think that the people are ready for that, or that that would really function in the system that we have right now. So what I would recommend is that rather than having the corporations being able to move the problem around and evade taxes and evade labor unions by just hopping over to a different country, that if we had a global governing body, we could then impose that, no, you can't move your problem around. I mean, you can up and move, but we're still going to tax you. We're still going to get this money. And then we can use those funds that we can make from taxing and spending into social programs that can help the people. And if we've got, you know, a voter base representative in each of these places, then the money will be allocated properly. Again, without, I think, undermining national efforts. If you want to have lower taxes in Taiwan to bring in these groups, I mean, you can still go ahead with that, but we're still going to manage to get our hands in the pockets, basically. Does that answer your question?
My big question is, how would you, this is obviously it's kind of a trick analogy, how would you suggest that we encourage or implement voting within other countries that are currently under a dictatorship? Because we see in the news every day that they rig elections, they do this, so that dictator could somehow put himself into that global government, and that would work for the best interest of the people, obviously, because maybe that person only has
Okay. Well, the thing is what I'm arguing for is that instead of, this would sort of be more of a parallel movement rather than trying to overrule the rule of nations. I don't think that we really have, as much as I would, you know, strongly oppose dictators, I would say that, you know, it's not my place to remove you from power. But basically, I would hope that they would encourage cooperation of this sense, how can we make sure that they don't rig elections? Well, I mean, I don't know how exactly we can not make sure that they don't rig elections. I do know that the UN currently has in place different programs that they can help run elections. So I'm sure that, you know, if we pooled the, 6,800,000,000 people, that we could come up with some sort of a system that would work. In respects to, like, would they be willing to work alongside with this other body of government? basically, these taxes, the money that I propose that this government would be able to generate, is money that does not fall in the hands of governing bodies right now. And if that's the case, it would just be a way of encouraging them that if you do work with these representatives of the people, you will be able to get a hold of this bigger pot of money, or at least get your share of this bigger pot of money. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's have one more question.
I know you spoke to trying to get voters more involved, more aware of Facebook and whatnot. How do you deal with making voting mandatory? And how does that apply to global justice?
I think making voting mandatory is a very tough thing, because I think if you don't vote, it can be a sign of your dissidence. It can be a sign that you don't approve of, you know, any of your representatives. You know, we have to have a certain quota in order to run a meeting. And I think if that quorum doesn't show up, then maybe we just realize that we have to try this again. I know that it can be costly, but I think that once we, you know, start pushing, you know, the issues, that people will come out. If we educate them, they should, if they know what's going on, we just have to figure out a way to say it so that they care. And that's something that, you know, perhaps all of us need to team up with. I mean, the advertising industry is huge, but we're just advertising the wrong sort of ideas. We need to turn advertising into education. And I think if we did that, then we would be able to drum up the voter support that would give us at least a representative of what the people want.
Well, thank you for all the questions. I'm sorry if you don't have time for any more, but let's just give Chan another round of applause.
All right. We'll give the judges a little bit of time to prepare their results. And in the meantime, I'll just let you know about a few upcoming events. The next Student Speaker Challenge is going to take place next Wednesday, February 9th at 12:15 p.m. in the same room. And it will feature Alex Maffei and Rory Tarrant. Yes, okay. All right, and I'm just going to let you know about a few other SACFA events. So there's going to be another session. It's called Is the Road Ahead Bumpy for Canadian Universities? And that will be on this Thursday, February 3rd, from noon to 1:30 at the Country Kitchen Catering, which is in the lower level of the keg. And Dr. Mike Mann will be speaking at that. So if you're interested, you can attend that. Another session happening next Wednesday evening, that's February 9th from 7 to 9 p.m., as well in the Country Kitchen Catering, is about the Can the Alberta Party Be a Viable Alternative in Provincial Politics? And the speaker is Sue Huff, and that's on Wednesday. So another session will be taking place on Thursday, February 10th, from noon to 1:30 at the Country Kitchen Catering, and this session is called Dialogue on Democracy, Should Voting Be Compulsory? Perhaps a few of you would be interested in that. And the speakers will be Heather McIntosh, Dan Shapiro, and Dr. Gordon Campbell. The same session will also be held on campus as well later in the afternoon. So if you can't make one session, maybe you can make the next one. So I think those are all the announcements. Good. I got the thumbs up. We'll just give the judges a few more minutes. You guys can grab some more refreshments while we're waiting.
Probably not.